go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. I'd like to welcome everybody here. It's 12 minutes after 9, February 20th, 2008. We had a slight delay due to a conflicting schedule down the hall with legislative budget and audit. So we're running a little bit behind, but with me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, good morning.
Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, and Senator Dyson. We have three items on the agenda today. We're going to start with Senate Bill 170, insurance coverage for well baby exams. And we're going to move on to Senate Bill 226, vexatious litigants. And Senate Bill 247, missing persons. We're going to, these are the initial hearings at this committee of all three of these bills. So we're going to have the bills presented, and then we're going to take some public input, and we're going to set all three bills aside for a later date. With that, I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 170, insurance coverage for well baby exams. And we'd like to invite Senator McGuire forward as the primary sponsor, bringing up her trusty staff I see right away. And with that, I'd like to have Senator McGuire take us through the bill. And we may have some questions, and we'll have a discussion with the department.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Finance Committee. I appreciate you having this bill up today. I'm going to just walk through. The bill is very simple in and of itself, but kind of the philosophy behind it. And then Trevor Fulton from my staff has been doing some research that was requested by the Senate HES Committee as to more of the cost savings and outcomes that well baby exams contribute to. So if after I'm done speaking, if he can put some of that stuff on the record, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 170 would require private insurers in the state of Alaska who offer insurance to also offer insurance coverage for well baby exams. Well baby exams are the series of 10 exams that occur in a child's first 24 months of life, so from birth to 2 years old. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, and probably many of the members of the committee know, the state requires a set of stepped out vaccinations that are a part of those first 2 years. And so it's a recognition on the part of public health of the state of Alaska that regular exams and regular vaccination schedules are critical to the long-term health of a child who will eventually grow into hopefully a productive, healthy adult. The impetus for this bill, and I understand people's hesitancy on mandates, Mr. Chairman, but the impetus really for this bill is the fact that there are many coverages out there that currently will offer things like prostate exams, colorectal screening, very costly emergency room visits and such, but will not offer and cover a very simple early stage well baby examination. And so we want to provide an incentive for doing that. What we know is that during these exams, and my apologies, and hopefully the next time the committee hears this bill, the two physicians that testified in the HES committee will be able to talk a little bit about the benefits, but the American Academy of Pediatrics actually works on the schedule of well baby exams, and it's through their work as pediatricians that they're able to assess what will come out of the exam, signs of neglect, malnutrition. Often you have a situation where you have new parents who are well-meaning but don't know what the right nutrition is, what the right proper care is for their child. It's also an opportunity for medical personnel to assess basic skills and development early on, language skills, motor development, hearing, vision, those kinds of things, Mr. Chairman. And what we know, and Trevor will talk a little bit about, is that often something uncovered in a well baby exam will lead to the prevention of an emergency room visit, which could be up into the thousands of dollars. So the philosophy behind it is a statement on the part of the legislature and of Alaska that we care for the youngest members of our society. We pass many bills in these halls that make a commitment to life and to the children in our society. They have no voice. They can't come before you with this bill today, and so I'm coming on their behalf to say that we ought to give them the best shot, give them a chance to have these exams, to have a healthy life. We spend a lot of money in later stages of life, Mr. Chairman, as you know, with insurance coverage, and we think it's a good idea to start out at the early stages. And I want Trevor to talk a little bit more about the cost savings.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record and then.
For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Lisa McGuire. And I have a fair amount of data here. I'll try and keep it short. And if there's any further questions, I would welcome them. I think a big question when it comes to well babies exam is who pays for it? And the research that I've conducted shows that there's an increase of about 0.1% to 0.3% to plans that offer no well child services. So if you look at a plan that offers absolutely no child well services and you compare that with a plan that offers full well child services, it's only an increase of between 0.1% and 0.3%. That increase would amount to anywhere from 37 cents to 84 cents increase to the employee per month, and a $1.40 to a $1.87 increase. The first number was for the employee per month, the smaller number, and the employer would be contributing an additional $1.40 to a $1.87 per member per month.
And then will you talk a little bit about some of the research in terms of the emergency?
Sure. In my research, I also found that among children with incomplete well child care in the first 6 months of life, and granted we're considering well baby exams for the first 24 months of life, but I do believe this research is pertinent, there's an increased risk of having an emergency room visit there's a fairly lengthy list of conditions here, but essentially there's a substantial increase in emergency room visits for all causes.
We can submit this for the committee to read through. It's research that we did between the last committee and this committee. I introduced the bill from a philosophical belief, as I stated, that it's the kind of thing that if we have a commitment to children, that this ought to be offered. And we've done that in the past, as you know, Mr. Chairman. Colorectal screening is a great example where we found that it was important for the state to step in and to encourage, to require providers to offer that because we felt it was life-saving and it was also cost-saving. Well baby exams are no different, and so that's the basis under which I offered it. But in the last committee, there was some question about whether or not well baby exams actually were a cost savings. And one of the other things I wanted to point out, which you may well know in the profession that you're in, is that there is a nationalized move among employers to shift to more of value-based budgeting strategies as opposed to budget-based allocations. And there's a big packet on that. This is provided as one example from the National Business Group on Health to employers themselves about how to think about the kinds of tools that they put in their coverages and what it will lead to in terms of value to their employees and then cost savings to the employer. So I'd encourage you to look at that and see. But again, I don't want to spend too much time on just the cost savings because, I think the commitment is that we have made over and over and over again in the legislature to say we value these children, we value life, and giving them an opportunity to have a physician give those regular inoculations, check on their nourishment, oversee their hearing and basic skills is going to give them the best shot at a good life.
Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? And we'll go to Senator Dyson and Senator Thomas.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've heard this in a bill in a previous committee, and I just offer the following comments for my fellow committee members. This is a good idea, and getting early intervention in childhood health issues is a valuable thing to do, and it also gives us a shot at somebody with expertise seeing an abused or neglected child that was really valuable. But I would offer a couple more comments. I have voted for insurance mandates before and have been rethinking that, and I hope our insurance commissioner who's here, or director, whatever it is, will comment on it. But as we've explored how to get more insurance companies here offering a wider variety of tailored insurance programs, we're fighting uphill against two or three things. One is we're a small market, and the cost-benefit ratio for them is marginal. Secondly, in their evaluation, one of the major factors they look at is how many mandates are there that limit the kinds of packages that they can offer. And of course, they've got a dog in the fight. And they will say, well, too many mandates make you an unattractive place to open shop, and so on. So we're going to go where there's less restrictions and we can do better. And they say that the number of mandates here we have, which is at least in the middle of the pack, if not in the higher amongst the states, works against us getting lots of choices here. And so that's a factor. And I also just caution us all, it's really easy to spend other people's money to do good things. And we'll hear another bill here on universal health care that shifts the burden to the insurance companies. And I thought Governor McCaskey 2 years ago was working around the edges of doing what I thought was a gutsy and principled move, and that was for we the taxpayers to assume the cost for indigent care, you know, as opposed to shifting it to third-party payers or to people who actually pay their own bills. And as you all know, there's a lot of cost shifting that goes on and a shell game there. And here we're doing it again. And I think that getting the well baby exams is a very good idea, but we don't take care of the indigent on people who don't have insurance in this, and we force it on to the insurance companies that is, I think, ultimately is not the right place to place the burden. If we as a culture decide, and I think we have drifted to it, that we're going to take care of everybody, and including those who can't or won't take care of themselves, then the only fair thing I think is to do is to make that a part of our tax base, that all of us citizens pony up and put our money where we think our convictions are. So just as encourage you all to think about this, and I'm glad you're giving us some time to think about it. That's a very responsible thing to do. That very good thing to do, good intentions, but there's a significant potential for unintended consequences, and it doesn't quite get at the really core problem. Thank you.
Senator Thomas, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
On the bill?
Yeah, it is. It's regarding the cost savings and the thought of looking at the idea of the over the time frame that we're talking about, fairly minimal amount of money for a dozen exams over a period of time, compared to the early detection of one particularly horrendous disease that might arise. So I wonder, and maybe you're not the ones that should answer the question. I'll ask it later if others testify. Of it seems somewhat short-sighted by the employers and their representatives to not look at that long range. I can understand the insurance companies potentially looking at it differently because they change who they're insuring, and that on a, probably a more regular situation than maybe the employees of a company. But I'm just wondering if you have a comment on that, why they look at it that way when there seems to be statistics that indicate that it is a cost savings over over the life of a child, even the early years of a child.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, you hit the nail on the head, and that's what I was referring to in this document that I'd love for you to read, is that there actually is a movement afoot among businesses, and you will hear from a representative of the NFIB here, and that, let me characterize it as a narrow opinion at this moment, but on the broader scale, businesses are talking about this, and you are dead on that they're the people to be talking about it, because insurance companies look at you from the moment in time that you are covered with them only. I mean, to be blunt, you're a number. It doesn't matter to them whether or not they prevent serious colorectal cancer at 45 and have the long-term costs of that if you're not covered by them. And so the thinking can be much more short-sighted. Employers who know their employees and who are setting up that value-based environment are really the ones who are going to have to make this push. But I also think policymakers have a role. And that's what I think I'm trying to say, is that sitting up at 30,000 feet, we can look down and know that prevention does save money. It makes a better, healthy civilization, and it's the right thing to do. I think employers are going in that direction. And this is just one example of a handbook or a toolkit out there that talks about investing in child health, maternal and child health, and what that will do for your employees and what it will do for the overall costs that you have. But I think Senator Dyson is right. The market has been small. It isn't as competitive, but I don't think that should discourage us from putting in good ideas to the discourse that happens. And frankly, it's an unfortunate thing, but sometimes it takes bills like this to interject that into the negotiation.
Do we have other questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Huggins.
A couple things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does Denali Kid Care do any of this?
Yes.
Would you give us a 10-second burst on that?
I'm sorry. I wish I had more data available through the chair, Senator Huggins. I would be very happy to follow you up with that information.
But okay. Well, that's fine.
What I do know is pretty general, and that Denali Kid Care does cover up until us. It's some percentage of the poverty level, and I don't know what that percentage is.
But it'd be interesting to know what percentage that is.
I didn't. Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, Denali Kid Care.
Mic forward,
I'm sorry. What Denali Kid Care? What they have some role here, and what percentage of coverage? So we, by deduction, figured out what segment of the population we're talking about. Okay. That's the first part. The second part, I happen to subscribe to Senator Dyson's theorem on this, but my question for the bill sponsor is, have we thought about, I mean, it's always easy for us as governmental people to shift the burden, in this case, to small businesses. Have we thought about incentives, tax breaks, I mean, whatever's out there that we can do for them to encourage?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I always think about tax breaks as incentives, but fortunately, we don't have a tax. So the federal government has gotten better at offering, and Fred and I talk about this a lot, pardon me, Senator Dyson, on HSAs and health savings accounts. The federal government has gotten better at allowing that, but we don't have a state tax per se, so there isn't an incentive that we could offer. I'm open to many different ideas, but I think what I'm trying to say is that you're, as is always the case, the folks that are indigent end up getting covered. The folks that are doing really well end up, and it's the folks that are working in the middle class that tend to have the most difficulty. And so this is really aimed at those folks that are getting up, working every day, you know, making a middle income. Perhaps some of them could qualify for Denali Kid Care. That's a whole nother conversation. There's that income threshold that always sits right there. But there is no state tax incentive to give.
Yeah, and finally, I mean, this is similar in some respects in my mind, that we as Alaskans always want to tax the other person, shift the burden, because it doesn't affect us. And I guess sitting around this table, I mean, I'm one of those people, and I think Senator Dyson is one of them, that is sensitive to that issue. So, you know, it's always easy to tell somebody else to do something, that you pay for it, and we'll all be happy. And I just think we have to be careful about entering into those kind of equations and extensions.
And through the chair, if I could just make a final point, I'm extremely sensitive as well. I see both sides of the equation. And on that point, I would be willing to offer a repealer on this bill that says that if costs can go up, and let's have the insurance companies come before us within a year's time and let us know how much these costs have gone up. Let the employers that are purchasing that tell us that they've gone up, and let's then go ahead and repeal it. I don't believe, personally, that the cost of adding well baby exams and adding some preventative care to a coverage is going to put insurance rates through the roof and drive small business out of town. I've just seen too much. There's a pendulum that moves there, but I'm sensitive to it as well.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, I guess one of the comments that I had to do with the tax. We could give incentives to the insurance companies by giving them a break on the state income tax, can't we? To allow them to go ahead and
business tax.
But my question had to do with how many other states have implemented well baby exams to be covered by insurance?
21.
So there are 29 others that aren't?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dyson, a question?
Yeah, no, I appreciate this discussion. And I caution all of us to not just get captured by the pragmatism argument, the effectiveness. You know, we do this thing and cost more money on the front end, and it'll save us money in the long run. And boy, that's an argument that really appeals to me. I've spent much of my life as a maintenance engineer. I would always say to my bosses, hey, fix this thing now when you have a chance and it's cheap, or fix it later when it's an emergency and everything's falling apart and it costs you lots more. Preventative kinds of things and interceding on the front end. And that makes sense. The pragmatism argument that, as Senator Huggins said, you know, good, here am I, send the insurance company, you know, or whoever is an easy one to fall into. But I got caught in my own hypocrisy here in this very argument 3 or 4 years ago, and it had to do with prostate screening. And it made so much sense that to do this screening that I said to the insurance companies quietly in my office, why aren't you dummies doing this? All the figures show that it saves you money as well as a great service to your clients. And they literally said to me, we should be. And if you guys pass this law, then we'll all do it. The playing field is equal for all of us, you know, and we'll all be doing the right thing. We'll all be making more money and saving our clients. So I went ahead and voted for that one.
But that's the same.
And, you know, and if the companies were saying the same sort of thing to me, I'd be swallowing hard, holding my nose, and saying, yeah, okay, if that's the position the industry in. But remember, the companies here, including all the private enterprise, that they go out and select an insurance company. They can pick from the insurance company, if there's lots of them here, and pick the one that they think is going to serve their employees the best. And I'm hoping that we'll get to the point where virtually every company, including the state, will offer to their employees, you know, and say to them literally, here's four different programs you can pick from. One that has the Cadillac or Lexus version, and here's the one that has a smart car version, you know, or whatever it is, and make those kinds of choices and so on. But I'm still wary about the mandates issue. Thank you.
Let's move right along. Try to keep on questions and keep on the bill here. With that, I'd like to go ahead and ask Ms. Hall to come forward from the Division of Insurance.
Thanks.
I like it.
You could please state your name and who you represent for the record, and then speak to the bill, and we'll try to direct questions, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. And I really didn't prepare any remarks about the bill. I would be happy to answer questions. As the Division of Insurance, we haven't taken a position on the bill, and I'm certainly not here to debate whether well baby care does or doesn't save cost effective. It's kind of like motherhood and apple pie, but there are lots of comments and questions that came up. It appeared to me as
does this
previous.
Bill apply to the state's health insurance plan?
No, it does not.
And why is that?
You want the short version or the long version,
well, we've
Mr.
had some
Chairman.
Long versions this morning. Maybe we'll start the short version. So we can
And not necessarily just, if I could just address, typically the Division of Insurance has not supported mandates, not that they're not always good causes, but when we pass mandates, and I think there are 9 in Title 21, I could be wrong on that count, they apply to a small segment of our population. About 4 years ago, we had a hearing on which some outside experts did some analysis of our population in the private industry. And in that analysis, we discovered about 350,000 Alaskans were covered under some type of private insurance, but only about 150,000 of that 350,000 actually were in plans regulated under Title 21. To transact insurance, which is the definition of what we regulate, you are an insurance company. We regulate things called multiple employer welfare arrangements, which are self-funded groups, and that regulation comes through the federal law. And self-insured employers are specifically preempted by ERISA laws. We do not regulate those, therefore any mandates do not apply to plans that are governed by the feds. In the middle, there are other plans, such as state plans, that it's up to the states. The states can regulate those if they choose. This body would be the policymaking body for that, to determine whether you want to put some type of statute that would require certain types of coverages. But as it stands today, we have not included those in our definition of transacting insurance. So it boils down to what is the definition of insurance.
So what is the impact on the private insurance?
The impact of
potential impact, I should say.
First, as this bill came to our attention last year, and the sponsor and I have talked about it, and I've talked with her staff, we did some research on forms, health insurance forms that are filed with the Division of Insurance. And in that review, we have found that there are very few restrictions in the private industry on well baby coverage. What may present a restriction would be if an employer, small or large, chooses a plan that may or may not cover certain things. And many of those plans are tailored to the wishes or needs of that particular group of employees. The employer would have the option to cover or not cover certain things. A maybe better example of that I can give you is we recently have a company that, probably recently, but maybe 18 months ago, added maternity coverage. They had never offered maternity coverage on individual health insurance plans. There was a clamor from their policyholders for maternity coverage, and they made their filings and we approved them, and they began to offer maternity coverage. Then the clamor came from people 50 and over. I don't want to plan with maternity coverage. So you can get into what's called adverse selection if you offer coverages that don't cover a broader group of people. And I'm going into way more detail than you ever wanted to hear, so I apologize.
Could you On page 2 of the legal service memorandum, there's a footnote that state employees do not receive health coverage through the state's health care plan. Instead, they receive it through the union trust plan. Do you want to elaborate on that?
There are different plans that different employees, depending upon the bargaining unit. Many of those coverages are done through the collective bargaining process, and I'm certainly not an expert on that. The state plan that I think we've been talking about is the select benefits plan that applies to all of you, to exempt employees and to the supervisory unit and retirees.
Do we have any other questions for Ms. Hall? Senator Olson, and we'll try to keep it to a question instead of statements, or we're not going to get done today with these bills. So. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that same thought of people over 50 not wanting maternity coverage, would that same segment of the clients also not opt for this well baby exam, and you get into the same clamor as well?
If the employer has those options, yes, they could do that. If you mandate the coverage, what you're really looking for in insurance is a pool. There are losses, certainly. Health insurance is very different than most kinds of insurance. You know you will have losses. So you want a pool of, to use a different example, healthy and unhealthy people who are paying the premiums that then allow the larger expenses from maybe a major surgery to be spread over a larger group. And in the individual market, when you mandate coverages, that people can then elect to not have coverage. If you're healthy, if you don't need maternity coverage, you may elect not to have coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dyson, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what our insurance coverage mandates do to the attractiveness of us as a market for the insurance industry?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, earlier I did listen to your comments, and you certainly have done research. You and I have talked about these issues. The more difficult or we make doing business in our state, the fewer insurance companies we're likely to attract. I am incredibly pleased at this particular point in time. In the last 2 years, we have added a company, an insurance company, to write in the small group market. I frankly don't know how successful they are or are not, but I know it is an alternative. And just in the last several months, we had an insurance company who's been here writing group coverage and who began writing in the individual market. So I think our marketplace right now is balanced sufficiently to attract companies. I'm not sure mandates would prohibit that, but you're right, the more difficult it is, the more mandates we require, the less flexibility to tailor programs in some of the employer markets, it does become more difficult. Typically, mandates are difficult to quantify in terms of cost. I've worked on various pieces of legislation over the 5 years I've been here, and I've never been able to get a good answer on what do the mandates cost. And the ranges that I get from insurance companies are anywhere from 1% to 5% of the premium. So typically mandates are not particularly expensive, but when you continue to add this one at 3% or 5% or whatever it may be, you increase the cost of insurance for a small group. And what we find typically, if we increase the cost of insurance, we have fewer people who purchase insurance. And that's probably the biggest concern I have as we make decisions that increase the cost of insurance. We tend to price people out of the market. Health insurance is expensive. I think everyone's aware of that. And I guess I would comment. I saw and approved a rate filing last week that will be a substantial increase in our individual marketplace and will eventually get to our small group marketplace. The cost of health care is increasing dramatically all over the country. And I spend a lot of time working with other regulators about areas that can maybe impact some of that. But the cost of insurance is directly related to the cost of care.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to the online and the off-net, and then we'll come back. I know there's a couple of people in the room that want to speak to us. So we're now going to go to the off-net to Dr. Mansinger from Children's Hospital. He's gone. Okay. Stephanie Birch, if you could put yourself on the record and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, good morning. I'm Stephanie Birch. I'm the section chief for Women's, Children's, and Family Health with the Division of Public Health, and I'm here to provide some information regarding this bill. The first 24 months of a child's life consist of rapid changes physically, developmentally, and socially. These months are considered some of the most critical in a child's life to assure later success in school and transition into adolescence. One of the primary purposes of well child visits is to identify children affected by any physical, mental, or developmental problems as early in life as possible. Approximately 16 to 18% of all children in the United States are diagnosed with disabilities that include speech, language impairments, mental retardation, learning disabilities, and emotional behavior disturbances. Yet only 20 to 30% of children with disabilities are diagnosed or start treatment before beginning school. Children with disabilities who enter early intervention programs prior to starting kindergarten are more likely to complete high school, enter or remain in the workforce, and avoid teen pregnancy, delinquency, and violent crime. Research shows that for every dollar spent on early intervention services for children with disabilities, $13 are saved. In an article that I pulled up by the health insurance mandate in the states for 2007, it was put together by the Council of Affordable Insurance. There are 31 states that mandate well child care, well child preventative visits with an expected cost, actuarial cost that's been estimated by this group of less than 1%. Most major private employers in the state of Alaska, those including our healthcare institutions such as Providence Alaska Medical Center, Alaska Regional Medical Center, Carr Safeway, who are self-insured, include a complete array of well-child visits up through age 21. The American Academy of Pediatrics and American Academy of Family Practice Physicians recommend a schedule of routine visits that coincide with expected developmental targets of children, not only during the first 24 months of life, as this bill is suggesting, but through toddlerhood, childhood, and the teen years. These visits include a full head-to-toe physical assessment, as well as screening for visual problems such as neonatal cataracts or cross-eyedness, dental caries, hearing loss, inappropriate weight for overfeeding or underfeeding, signs of physical abuse or neglect, mental health, and bonding status, as well as developmental milestones. In addition, during the well-child visits, which are designed to help parents learn how to care for their children and address common problems without going to the emergency room. Such topics, guidance topics, also include injury prevention, discipline, handling behavioral problems, and nutrition, which help to reduce parental stress, parental productivity, and reduce lost work days due to childhood illness. A search of the literature that I have done identified several studies citing the cost-benefit to well-child preventative care. One study conducted in 2002 that's published in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine indicates that children with incomplete well-child care visits in the first 6 months of life, there's an increased risk of having emergency room visits for upper respiratory tract infections, gastroenteritis, asthma, and all causes.
Ms. Birch, could I get you to wrap up, please?
Sure. One comment I would just make then, and I can provide my testimony to you in writing, is during a well-child visit, with every visit, unintentional injury is covered significantly. And there are several studies that have been produced to indicate what a cost savings that this has provided just in covering unintentional injury. During acute care visits with children, you don't necessarily have time to cover all of the well-child preventative kinds of things that you normally would be covering, and that's why it's so important in a child's life to be covering these. There are numerous other studies that I can provide for you that discuss the cost benefit of well-child care. Children can greatly benefit from a protective and preventative system. The Department of Health and Social Services supports this bill and its intent to promote health and detect problems early and refer to appropriate providers. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll go on now to Susan Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and other members of the Senate Finance Committee for allowing me to speak. I'm Susan Johnston. I'm the Director of Compensation Benefits and HR Information Systems for Providence Alaska Health and Services. Wanted to speak a little bit today about the coverage that we do offer that is like the coverage proposed in the bill and some of the reasons that we do that. Our plan, which is self-funded, does provide the same coverage proposed following the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations. We have been offering some form of well baby checkup coverage for at least the past 10 years, looking back on our records, enhancing it as we see these recommendations change throughout the years. When we look at some of the reasons why we do this, when I look at the cost of our health insurance, typically about 70% of our claims are for 20% of the population, and that's the 20% of the unhealthy population. So when we look at offering a benefit like this, it is to keep the healthy population healthy, which allows us to, yes, save costs, but also to look at the quality of life that we may be providing, say, for a child. During these routine exams, we can detect maybe an acute illness such as asthma and be able to treat and manage that disease, which would look at reduced cost in ER visits, not only for us as the employer, but also for that family. They have less co-pays and other things that are they have to spend on this. When we look at the cost of that, we're looking at about $1,500 roughly for the cost of providing this benefit through age two, as opposed to probably a $500 to $1,500 or more cost of an ER visit. This is one way that we can help maintain our cost and not have to continue to raise our premiums that our employees are having to pay for their insurance.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Johnson. Now I'm going to go on to Dr. Jody Butto.
Hello, yes, thank you. My name is Jody Butto. I'm a pediatrician in Anchorage. I'm the president for the American Academy of Pediatrics here in Alaska. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has been, as previously stated by Mrs. Birch, very eloquently, is very much in favor of this bill in that we wholeheartedly support well child visits through age 21, but particularly in the first 2 years of life and or up to first 5 years of life. And as has been previously stated numerous times, the studies have shown that this is very cost-effective care. The Denali KidCare population receives this care because it has been shown time and time again to be cost-effective. And just as the woman from Providence has stated, that with Denali KidCare, 75% of the population who uses Denali KidCare or uses Alaska Medicaid only uses 25% of the resources, and that would be the same for regular insurance too. That it's very cost effective. It's a relatively well population that utilizes a small amount of resources and that keeps them healthy. And so we would very much like to stand in support of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our off-net. We'll now come back to the room and ask Mr. DeWitt to come forward, please. If you could state your name and who you represent for the record and speak to the bill. And I know you know the process well, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Denny DeWitt. I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Businesses. And we do oppose Senate Bill 170. It's not an issue for us about whether or not there's value in well baby visits. For us, it's an issue of who pays and who makes those choices. Employers have a limited amount of funds for employee compensation. We believe it ought to be left to the employer and the employees to decide how that compensation is decided. Each and every mandate that's put on us by an external force limits the choices that employers and employees have for providing insurance. And in terms of understanding the need for these services, I'm the father of five. I understand this well. I'm grandfather of five, and I'm talking to my kids about health care. So that's not really, I think, the issue of this bill. The issue of this bill is whether or not there ought to be mandates for how those benefits are decided. This bill covers a very small portion of our population. For example, state employees are not covered under this bill. Big box stores, one of the competitors of most of my members, not covered under this bill. They mostly have ERISA plans. So you're selecting a very small group that has to come up with funding for a decision that you're making about what our employees want for their coverage. We don't think that's the appropriate way for us to move. Our estimates from the information we have is this could add 1 to 3% to the cost of insurance. What we're finding in the surveys that we have is that new employers, particularly small employers, are opting not to offer health insurance at all because of the cost. This effectively is one more brick in the knapsack that makes it more difficult for new employers to even begin to offer health insurance coverage to employees. So we think that while the concept of well-baby visits is a very good one, and we certainly support that notion, what this bill does in terms of the mandates and the probable unintended consequences will probably reduce the amount of insurance coverage provided by small employers in Alaska.
Thank you. Do we have questions for Mr. DeWitt? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at some of the percentages you just discussed, 1 to 3%, what does that average out to dollars as far as what has to be paid by either the small employer or the employee?
I don't have the number, but I would suspect that the numbers that the sponsor offered are probably not very far off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. DeWitt, in your role as a representative of small business, I understand your concern about mandates being passed along, and I share that to some degree. But it would seem to me that if you generally agreed that a particular mandate had some positive effect and overall was a savings in the long run, that you would be prepared to argue with the insurance companies as a group that an increase in premiums in this particular case is unreasonable, thereby kind of setting the stage for others to do the same, to step up and say, wait a minute, you know, you guys raise the premium every time something is suggested, regardless of whether there are studies that indicate that in the long run it saves money. So I guess the question is, do you do that, I guess? Do you gather those statistics and actually advocate for your members in that regard, as well as coming here and advocating for your members against ones that might potentially actually cost money, more money, but maybe good-natured, but do not, in the long run, statistically save money?
Excuse me, the NFIB in Alaska has not been active in that. Nationally, we have in a number of states. And I'm trying to find out exactly why we're not doing that program here. Don't specifically have an answer. One of the things I can tell you is that our members are small. It would seem to me that what you're offering would be much better if the state were mandated to cover. The state then would come back with the data to show that, in fact, the numbers that are being proposed might be accurate. The state's a much larger group, has much more power than a small two or three person employed operation that I represent in terms of dealing with insurance companies. So it seems to me that you've got this backwards. What we're suggesting is small employers who have the most difficulty dealing with large insurers are the ones that you're mandating move ahead. You're not dealing with any Taft-Hartley Union Trusts. You're not dealing with the state employee program. You're not dealing with any ERISA programs, all of whom have shown that they have substantial ability to do those kinds of negotiations, certainly much more ability than some of the small retailers that I represent.
I'm sure many would probably support that. It'd be broadened anyhow, but thank you for your response.
Senator Elton, you had a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, we've heard this bill before, or I've heard this bill before, and Mr. DeWitt, it's easy, I think, to identify the costs that may be associated to an insurance plan with mandates. And I mean, you've provided me additional information. I appreciate that. But it's more difficult to talk about other benefits that can accrue from having a healthy family, and especially for a small business with few employees. I mean, if in fact you reduce sick leave, if in fact you reduce the need for you know, parents to, you know, tend to a child that may not have been getting the kind of care that the child ought to have been given, those kind of costs. It's easier to identify the cost to an insurance plan than it is to identify the cost to an employer of having a more stable workforce, and a workforce that's perhaps more productive because they're not spending time away from the job. Has that been part of the debate among your membership?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, certainly our employers, our members are interested in having their employers healthy, well, productive. It's an important part of what they do. In the businesses that I represent, if one employee is out, that's a significant hole. The state has 16,000 employees. When someone goes home, it's not much of a hole. When you've got 3 to 5, maybe 10, when one employee's not there, it does make a lot of difference. So yes, those are important issues. Our point here is that how those issues are approached need to be tailored to the employee group and the kind of business. For example, we have one business that I'm familiar with that hires a number of folks out of the halfway house. They spend a lot of time with folks who they're working to rehabilitate. Their approach to keeping folks on the job and productive is different than another one that I represent, which is a suburban retail outlet that has a fairly healthy population. And that may be different than one that has a very young population with folks who have young children who have sometimes need to have the parents at home when they're sick. So we know our employees pretty well, and we try and tailor our programs to focus on the kinds of employees that we have and the kind of businesses we run. So I think we do look at those things, and I'm not suggesting, NFIB has not suggested, that any member is opposed to having well baby coverage as a benefit. What we're suggesting is that the appropriate place for that decision to be made is between the employer and the employees, not here by people who don't know our employees or our businesses, don't know what they need or how we need to tailor our benefits for the best benefit of our employees.
If we could kind of wrap up, and then we've got a couple more bills we want to hit. Do you have a quick follow-up, Senator Elton?
No, I don't. Thanks.
With that, thank you for your testimony. We'd like
thank
to
you,
bring
Mr. Chairman.
The bill sponsor back for some final comments before we set this bill aside.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Most of the people around this table have sat through insurance mandate debates before, and there's always more to the debate than just what you're hearing on the record, and I think you were starting to scratch the surface, in particular, Representative Senator Thomas. There is a lot of reading that you can do. We have provided some information in the packets. But what I would just like to encourage members to consider is that what we have shown in the past
is that when we have done these mandates, the insurance companies have not increased their rates in these astronomical amounts the way that they talk about. They have not picked up their bags and gone home. Businesses have thrived, and I'll spend some more time with Denny DeWitt, but there are small businesses out there that are looking at the kinds of things that Senator Elton brought up, but it requires thinking outside of the box. It is my hope that the state would follow. The state has followed in every case before, Mr. Chairman, with colorectal screening and prostate screening, and I think the state being a participant is a cost savings because the pool gets bigger. I would also be open to putting that into this bill specifically, but as you heard from the Director of Insurance, it requires a lot of changes to the law. The other thing is I'd be open to putting a repealer. I think it'd be interesting to let this go forward and again have a repealer that says that if the sky does fall and so forth, that it is repealed. I think with all due respect that you're gonna see savings, you're gonna see the negotiation shift, and oftentimes I think Mr. DeWitt's right. Small businesses aren't in the place to negotiate very well, and this is one tool that we can give them to help.
Okay, thank you. With that, we're gonna go ahead and set that bill aside. We're gonna go on to Senate Bill 226, Vexatious Litigants. First time this bill has been heard. The intent, like the last bill, is we'll hear this bill and then we'll set it aside after we take some public testimony and get the bill on the record. With us today to present this bill and I think the following bill, Senator French. Senator French could come forward. The seat is all warmed up. Present the bill, please. And we're going to try to, we've got about 50 minutes, we're going to try to get both these bills on the table today. If at all possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to appear in front of you this morning. SB 226, titled Vexatious Litigants, is in essence a tool to give the court.
You want to identify yourself for the record, please?
Beg your pardon, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hollis French, representing Senate District M and the State Senate.
Thank you.
SB 226 creates a process in statute for courts to manage the problem of lawsuits brought by individuals who are vexatious litigants. The bill would define a vexatious litigant as someone who, among other things, repeatedly litigates the same claims or brings claims that they've lost in the past back again to court when they've already lost that lawsuit. They file multiple frivolous lawsuits. They repeatedly file pleadings or motions that are frivolous or in bad faith, and repeatedly engage in tactics that are without merit or intended to cause unnecessary delay. The bill would allow the courts to impose reasonable restrictions on these vexatious litigants' access to court. Under SB 226, a court can require conditions such as the posting of a security or the pre-filing review of a complaint by the presiding judge before an action by a vexatious litigant can be filed in court. Several states have passed similar legislation to control the problem of vexatious litigation. California was a leader in this, Mr. Chairman. In 1963, they passed a vexatious litigant statute. Other states have followed suit. Hawaii passed a vexatious litigant statute back in 1993. Ohio did so in 1996. Texas did so in 1997. Florida did so in the year 2000. Most of them are patterned on California's statute. Our bill is patterned on California's as well. I would not say that vexatious litigation is an enormous problem for the court system as a whole, Mr. Chairman, but I would say it's a big problem for the targets of these lawsuits, and it's a problem for the judges that have to handle them because they frequently become named defendants when the decisions go against the vexatious litigants. The cases do needlessly burden the resources of the court system. They create an unnecessary expense for the individuals who are the target. I think it's important to recognize that you have to protect an individual's right to litigate claims in our court system. That's the hallmark of our system of justice. SB 226 is not intended to throw that balance out of whack. It just affects those few cases that are clearly without merit. The bill provides a means for screening out extreme examples of meritless cases before they're filed. I know there are representatives here from the Department of Law, Mr. Chairman, who work in this area, who have more experience in this area. I was a law clerk for a judge, and I saw one or two of these cases. They're typically voluminous. They're frequently handwritten, or they're copies of lawsuits that have been filed in the past. Simply slap a new sort of title page on the lawsuit and refile it again, and they can take up enormous amounts of time. I'd be happy to answer your questions or questions of the committee, Mr. Chairman, but I would point out that we have experts in the field sitting behind me that can probably provide more detailed answers. Thank you.
We have questions for Senator French, no sponsor. Senator Elton.
Just a quick one, Mr. Chair. And Senator French, you may want to defer this to somebody from the court system. Have you talked to the court system? I mean, will there be any costs associated with this to the court system as they make a determination on whether or not the litigant is a vexatious one? I mean, will they need special masters? Will they need additional personnel to help make that determination?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I think I'll let them speak for themselves. But my sense is that their belief is that the costs will be fairly minimal, if at all. That the cost of deflecting the lawsuit would certainly be less than the cost of processing the lawsuit, if you will. So there would be probably a net savings to the system.
We're going to have the department up next.
And then just another quick one for the sponsor. Was there any discussion on whether or not to provide a time limit? For example, if a vexatious litigant hasn't filed any kind of an action for 10 years or 15 years, that they drop off the list?
Sort of a probationary period. It's an interesting idea. I'm just looking at the bill briefly to see if there's a... There is, in essence, an answer to your question on page 3 of the bill, lines 12 through 16, sort of define what a vexatious litigant is, and you'll see that a vexatious litigant who is a person, first of all, who acts without a lawyer. The court system and the Department of Law will tell you that there are mechanisms in place to sort of rein in rogue lawyers that file meritless pleadings, but this is for individuals who work without a lawyer. And this defines a vexatious litigant as someone who's commenced, prosecuted, or maintained as the plaintiff at least 5 litigations during the preceding 7 years. So that's the short answer to your question is that if you've only filed 4 litigations in 7 years, you're not on the list. Or if it's been 5 and 6 years, you're not on the list. You've got to get 5 and 7. And so the passage of time would push you off the list and back into the realm of folks who can file at will, if you understand my answer.
Thank you, Senator French. If you're on the receiving end, most people would feel it's a frivolous case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huggins.
Getting back to the vexatious litigant means a person acting without the assistance of an attorney. What if we just struck without the assistance of attorney? And I know you mentioned there's a mechanism, but what if we just struck that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, from my own personal point of view, it wouldn't, as the carrier of the bill, it wouldn't offend me because, in my view, it's, I don't think it would affect any card carrying bar member.
Right.
But it'd be interested in hearing the point of view of the Department of Law or the court system.
We'll ask them when they come up. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Senator.
Thanks. In the interest of speed, you can get back to me. But it seems to me by reading the definition of a vexatious litigant, which one of my staff members, by the way, suggested would be a great name for a rock band.
Or a softball team.
Or a softball team. But it seems to me that if there's a neighborhood issue and somebody sues 6 neighbors and loses, they then are classified, and it could be over the same issue, that they would be classified a vexatious litigant and would have to reach an additional threshold to be allowed to go to court again.
And through the chair, Senator Elton, I think I'll defer that question to the Department of Law. I think they can probably provide a better
thank you
analysis of that than I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions initially for the bill sponsor, we'll go ahead and ask the Department of Law to come forward. Ms. Cox, if you can identify yourself, who you represent, and I'll just let you go ahead and start answering those series of questions without having the questions repeated. Maybe you can kind of repeat the question and then go into your answer, and it'll help speed things up a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Susan Cox. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law here in Juneau, and I am familiar with Senate Bill 226. Through the chair, I know one of the areas of questioning was about if you were declared to be a vexatious litigant because of routinely filing litigation within a certain period of time and then refrained from doing so for another period of time, could you be removed from the requirements of getting of a pre-filing order? This legislation before you is modeled on the California Code of Civil Procedure, which was enacted in over 40 years ago. And there is a process in California simply by applying to the court, the presiding judge who has issued a pre-filing order in the past to have it vacated. And that's according to the California's website. I believe that, as Senator French alluded to, if you have been declared a vexatious litigant and are subject to a pre-filing order by virtue simply of filing the requisite number of suits within a seven-year period, and then additional time passes with no litigation on your part, that would be certainly a process that could be followed in this state to have the pre-filing order vacated for future purposes. As far as the number of suits, it should be noted again that this legislation does not in any way bar someone's access to the courts. It simply places some restrictions or conditions precedent to litigating for vexatious litigants, and those are people who have a track record of abusing their right to access the court. So they may be required to either post security before they proceed with further litigation, or they may be required to show to the satisfaction of the presiding judge in the judicial district in which they want to file another lawsuit that their suit has some merit and is not simply repeated litigation of the same causes of action that have been previously decided, or that have re-raising issues against the same parties that have been sued about the same thing over and over. In this case, one of the definitions for a vexatious litigant is someone who has been the plaintiff in at least five litigations in the past 7 years that were either decided against that person or that they filed and then did not prosecute in a timely manner. There are several other ways in which you could be found by the court to be a vexatious litigant. But again, even if you were termed to be one, that wouldn't mean you couldn't file legitimate litigation. You would just have to meet certain requirements before going forward.
Senator,
I understand all of that, I think. I'm just stumbling a little bit over the fact that a person could become a vexatious litigant, not because they filed five different actions about a different situation, but I use the example of a neighborhood situation in which a person who's aggrieved or believes they're aggrieved over one thing might file six or seven or eight different actions just because of one thing that happened in a neighborhood, and then would be on the vexatious litigant list. And I understand that they would still have access to the courts, but that access provides an additional threshold that they would have to meet. And I'm stumbling a little. I understand if we've got somebody that, you know, in one instance goes out and tries to sue, you know, X over, you know, mail order goods, and Y over, you know, garbage being left on the curb. That is easy for me to get to, but it's more difficult for me to get to the issue that one instance and one issue that involves several different people may put them in the same class as the troublesome person.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, the definition would require at least five different lawsuits by the same person within the past 7 years, other than small claim actions, and they would have to be all decided adversely to the person bringing the lawsuit or have been abandoned without process. So in the case of someone's got the same issue against a variety of neighbors, it's more likely they're going to file one suit with all the neighbors or that those cases may be consolidated. This definition is parallels the one in the used by the California court, and obviously could be altered somewhat, but the examples that I'm familiar with in which we've had experiences with people who would fit in this definition of a vexatious litigant, or there's several different possible definitions here. We have not, that situation you've posed has not really raised itself at all. It's been people who repeatedly file, not just against the state, but against the same entity against whom they have a claim over and over again. And although the court system eventually gets around to saying, no, you can't do that because there are judicial doctrines that prohibit that, you still have to go through a very lengthy process to get to that result.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thomas.
Just one short question. If this bill, or if this were law today, how many people do you feel would be in that category as vexatious litigants?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I am familiar with a number of people who we did some research within the Department of Law to identify folks who might fall in this category, and I could say there are at least a half a dozen people who would likely fit in this definition, and additionally, probably at least another half a dozen who file litigation against the Department of Corrections, who may be inmates, who recreationally litigate, who would probably also fit this definition. A number of people in the private sector file suits against folks who are in the private sector and handled by private attorneys. Some of those cases end up also involving our office, but and I'm aware of some of those. I don't have the ability to guess how many total, but I would imagine it's still probably less than 20 people. At least that would be my best guess.
Good, thank you.
Final questions for the department, Senator Huggins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cox, on page 3, line 12,
mm-hmm.
and 13, if we struck without the assistance of an attorney, is that, I understand the rationale of the court system has ways of dealing with attorneys, but why can't we just strike that? A person who?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the intention of this bill has been directed at people who abuse the court system without the assistance of an attorney, primarily because those are people against whom there are no other meaningful controls. Where when a litigant files repeated litigation with the assistance of an attorney, the attorney is barred by rules of ethics and contempt of court and other means. There are ways to control it. So we just don't see problems of vexatious litigation along these lines filed by people who are represented by attorneys.
Right. So it doesn't hurt if we take it out then, if it's not a problem.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I don't know that you would be adding anything or taking anything away from the bill. It's just been the intention to address the what we call the pro se litigant, the one who files suit on their own behalf without a lawyer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why, how did we arrive at 5 and 7 years, and why not 3 and 6 or 5 and 10?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, is simply modeled on what California has had in place for over 40 years, and that's where it came from.
So what California does, Alaska does.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. A follow-up to the question by Senator Huggins. If you struck the language that says means a person acting without the assistance of an attorney. If you strike that, do you create a problem for attorneys? I mean, could there be a bar action against an attorney who may represent these kinds of litigants?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I guess the one thing that could raise a question, if it just says means a person who commences litigation, it does say as the plaintiff. So again, it would still appear to require only the party to be penalized here and be declared a vexatious litigant, well, at least in the A definition. The others aren't so clear. Whether, for instance, the definitions of B, C, or D could actually pertain to the lawyer and not just their client. And that could definitely cause some problems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have any final questions for the department? Okay, thank you. We have nobody from the LIOs or the OFFNET. I guess we have a volunteer from the crowd that wants to come forward and enlighten us. You can identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Doug Woolover, administrative attorney for the court system. Just to respond to the question from Senator Elton regarding any fiscal impact on the court system, I don't see any from this bill. These people, by definition, are routinely using court resources, so the hearing that would ensue from a motion to have someone declared a vexatious litigant is not likely to impact the court one way or the other. I do want to say that this bill will almost certainly be challenged before the court by the very people who are its target. So the court doesn't take a position on the merits of the bill because we will be resolving that probably in the Supreme Court. But in terms of the fiscal impact on the court, I don't see any from this bill.
Okay, thank you. Senator Elton.
You don't see a negative fiscal impact nor a positive fiscal impact?
I suspect, through the chair, Senator Elton, that in the long run, this probably does save the court some time and effort, as long as people don't, as long as, I don't imagine this is going to be commonly used, as both the department and the sponsor suggested. There are really a handful of people who are responsible for most of what might be termed vexatious litigation. So it's an important issue, but a relatively small one.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to roll back the calendar here a little bit. We've got Mr. Peter Masson online.
Yes, this is Peter Masson.
You can go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
My name is Peter Masson. It's M-A-A-S-S-E-N. I'm a lawyer in Anchorage in private practice, and I'm here to represent myself. I've been practicing law in Alaska for most of the last 27 years, and I do a mix of plaintiffs and defense work. I'm here to speak on behalf of the bill. I think it's a good idea, and it adds a necessary tool to the toolbox that trial judges have in Alaska. I need to say at the outset, though, before I go too far, that I, on principle, am strongly opposed to almost any efforts that would limit people's access to the courthouse. As a participant in the process, I'm, of course, a strong proponent of the judicial system. I think it's a vital institution, and private litigation has a very important role to play in the functioning of a peaceful society like ours. But that said, sometimes things can go too far. My particular odyssey began in 2002, over 5 years ago now. I was asked to defend a private landlord, a family partnership, in a suit by one of their tenants, a man named Daniel DiNardo. They were trying to evict him for non-payment of rent, and he sued them for trespass, battery, breach of contract, and a whole bunch of other causes of action. I was retained by State Farm Insurance to defend the landlord against those claims. That's the sort of thing I do, and it's the sort of thing that the courts are designed to handle routinely. But Mr. DiNardo is one of these litigants who does things differently. Partway into this initial suit, he sued me and my law firm and the trial judge for allegedly conspiring together on some of the judge's discovery rulings. So the first suit had to be put on hold while the second one was taken care of. And that was just the beginning of the process. That first suit was finally resolved in the Alaska Supreme Court just last year. But since it began in 2002, my clients, the landlord family partnership, have been sued by Mr. DiNardo five more times, or maybe six, depending on how you count. My firm and I have been sued five more times, and as recently as June of 2007. And every new lawsuit sort of builds on the one that preceded it. Mr. DiNardo loses a case, or he loses an important ruling in a case, and then he files another lawsuit against all the players in the earlier case, claiming that they somehow cheated him out of victory. There have been, by my count, a total of 11 lawsuits stemming from the original 2002 attempt to evict Mr. DiNardo, not just involving me and my clients, but also involving some of the trial judges. Now, Mr. DiNardo hasn't won a single one of these lawsuits. We have a number of judgments against him for attorney's fees and costs, but we'll probably never recover them, and monetary sanctions have never been a useful deterrent for Mr. DiNardo's proceedings. Litigation is what I do for a living, of course, but it has impacted me personally in some ways that I didn't really expect getting into this. My wife and I were getting financing for a new home, and banks, of course, want to know whether you're involved in litigation, so I had to explain that, yes, I've been sued X number of times by Mr. DiNardo, and he's seeking $5 million in damages against me, but he's not going to exceed, and here's why. These are things that are of concern to banks, obviously, and they understood eventually my explanation, but it's a problem. I've heard it said that trial courts have the tools to deal with cases like this on summary judgment and motions to dismiss and things like that, but my perception is they really don't, at least not efficiently, particularly if there's a long complaint that's been filed with many causes of action. A judge can't just look at it and say, I don't like this, and throw it out. You wouldn't want a judge to do that, to have that unilateral power. This is an adversarial system, and it's typically up to the other side to explain to the judge why, under the law, the first cause of action should fail, the second one should fail, etc. But filing motions for summary judgment and motions to dismiss, even if they're on easy issues like res judicata, you know, this thing's been decided before, judge, it's a long and expensive process, and it is wearing on the litigants. It costs money from the insurance company, or if it's uninsured, the party itself, and it's a diversion for the court system.
So could you wrap up, please, Mr.?
Yes.
We're running behind on the calendar.
I'm sorry. At some point, it seems to me that players in the system deserve to lose the presumption that they're entitled to their day in court, and I think this bill is entitled to address that and would do so effectively. That's why I support it.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
With that, I'd like to bring the bill sponsor back, and Senator French, in brief closing, so we have the opportunity to hear your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just 2 points. Important checks on the declaration of whether someone is a vexatious litigant is found on page 3, line 17. It's not so much that you've simply filed five lawsuits in 7 years, but that they have been finally decided adversely to you. And by a final decision, that doesn't mean, you know, one or two losses in a trial court. That means a final decision either by a jury, a judge, or the Alaska Supreme Court. So that's a fairly, you know, a fairly significant legal milestone. Also, keep in mind that the judge retains discretion as to whether or not to declare you a vexatious litigant. I think if he sees a homeowner, you know, engaged in a good faith action against 20 neighbors because of a sewer line problem or an easement problem or a trespass problem, that's going to be handled differently than the situation that Mr. Mawson just described, where you see someone suing not just the landlord, but then the insurance company, and then the attorney and the judge on the other side in this sort of expanding, never-ending legal morass that some people find themselves in. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll close and say thank you for hearing the bill.
And I did misspeak earlier. The next bill isn't yours, so you won't have to present it.
But I'm still hurrying to give the next presenter plenty of time, Judge, or Mr. Chairman, sorry.
Thank you.
That was on purpose, wasn't it?
Okay, we're going to go ahead and set that bill aside, and we're going to bring up Senate Bill 247, missing persons. We've got about 25 minutes, so hopefully we'll be able to get through that bill, depending on how many people come online. This is the first time this bill has been before the committee. Again, the intent here is just to hear this bill and set it aside. We're going to take public testimony on the bill today. And here to present the bill is Mr. Darwin Peterson. And if Mr. Peterson could identify himself, who he represents, and then I guess who he works for, and then who he represents, because there's a little difference here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. I appreciate the committee's indulgence to allow me to introduce this bill. I was working for the Senate President, who was a sponsor of this legislation when it was drafted, and due to the compressed session and her workload, she's asked me to continue staffing this bill, and the chairman has graciously allowed me to do that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also joined by Dirk Kraft from Senator Green's staff. He's been helping me with this bill. The language found in Senate Bill 247 was born in August 2005 as model legislation drafted by the U.S. Department of Justice. That was as a result of the President's DNA initiative. In response to their charge of improving the process for finding missing persons, they recommended that states adopt a version of the bill that you have before you. Senator Green was made aware of the need for this legislation through one of her constituents, Ms. Mary Weir. Ms. Weir is online today and will be sharing her story with you when we get to public testimony. But it was because of Ms. Weir's advocacy on behalf of all missing persons that Senator Green decided to introduce this bill. The legislation you have before you is quite different from the model legislation. It's been Alaskanized by our legislative legal department and taken into consideration issues like privacy and things in Alaska that are different than other states. With that, I'd like to highlight some of the specifics of the bill for the committee. It prohibits the disposal of unidentified human remains until DNA samples can be taken. Prohibits a law enforcement agency from refusing to accept a missing persons report. Provides a detailed list of specific information to be gathered and recorded by law enforcement about a missing person. It allows law enforcement to obtain a DNA sample from the family of a missing person who has been missing for more than 30 days and forward that DNA to an approved facility for analysis and dissemination into missing persons databases. It requires all missing persons reports to be entered into the National Crime Information Center missing person file, the unidentified person file, and the state crime information system. And finally, it provides a mechanism for law enforcement to determine if a missing person is deemed high risk, and if so, take immediate action. If we can increase the cooperation among law enforcement agencies and improve their ability to locate and safely return missing persons, this is a worthwhile effort. I appreciate the time, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Elton.
Thanks, and I recognize the time also. So these are questions I have, and please don't feel like you need to respond today. But they kind of fall under the refusing to accept provision of a missing persons report. And on page 2, section 3, line 7, each law enforcement agency in the state with reason to believe a missing person is in the jurisdiction served by the agency shall accept. I mean, I'm assuming by reading this language, I'm assuming that a family member of a person they believe missing that happens to live in New York City could call a law enforcement agency in the state of Alaska and say, you know, my brother set off on a road trip and said he was headed to Alaska and we haven't heard from him. That person could, under this model legislation, if we adopt it here, or this version of the model legislation, that person could call Alaska or any other state between New York City and Alaska that has adopted the model legislation and initiate on the part of law enforcement a certain series of steps that's going to take a considerable amount of time. Am I misreading that could happen?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, no, you're not misreading it. That is accurate. If people have reason to believe that a missing loved one is in Alaska and they call law enforcement in Alaska, they don't have to be an Alaskan resident to initiate the mandatory report requirement.
Okay. And another question that kind of gets to the issue of not law enforcement not being able to refuse a report. Am I correct, given kind of the some of the descriptions, especially the high-risk missing person, if an Alzheimer's patient wanders away from a Pioneer home or a nursing home, law enforcement would be, if somebody called and said, my grandma's missing, or my grandpa's missing, law enforcement would have to go through all of these procedures, regardless of how long that person had been missing from the home?
And through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, the law enforcement would have to initiate the missing person investigation if, in your example, an Alzheimer patient wanders away from the hospital, and that person would be deemed high risk in the section of the legislation where it outlines all the criteria for what is a high risk missing person. It specifies that if the person is in need of medical attention or on prescription medication, that they would be deemed high risk.
And earlier in the bill, if I could follow up.
Go ahead, Paul.
And earlier in the bill, it kind of says, regardless of the period of time a person is missing. This could initiate, on behalf of law enforcement, a rather significant effort, despite the fact that, you know, hopefully in many of these cases, a person is found in the neighborhood in a relatively short period of time. That's my understanding of it. And another question, the final one on this topic, Mr. Chair. I would imagine that given I tried to find in the bill something that would preclude law enforcement from having to accept a report, for example, if a crab boat goes missing in the Bering Sea. I mean, that's a search and rescue kind of thing, but a family member could make a determination that, well, here's another avenue that we have for, you know, what has been a kind of a tragedy on the high seas. Could a family member do that, or could somebody else initiate a missing persons report, even if it's kind of a search and rescue effort?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's a very good point. Yes, they would be able to. The way I read the legislation, if the person is missing, even if other law enforcement agencies are actively looking for that person, local law enforcement, police departments, or the state troopers would have to take that report. I would assume that families would cooperate with say the Federal Coast Guard or whoever is conducting the search, and that wouldn't become an issue. But there's no guarantee in the legislation that they wouldn't be able to file that report.
Yeah. Okay. That's it on this topic.
Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor initially? Okay. We have three fiscal notes, and concerning this bill, first one is zero. And the second one from the Department of Public Safety for $186 to modify the state's public safety information network. And then there's $206,000, these are in thousands, $206.8 for an additional investigative position of public safety. Just so the committee members can reference the fiscal notes. And, Mr. Peterson, do you want to speak to those notes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any comments on them?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The fiscal notes submitted by the Department of Public Safety, as you correctly explained, they do modify the state's APSIN and also hires an extra investigator. If the legislation moves forward in its current version, we believe that these fiscal note requests are legitimate. The workload would increase with regard to missing persons reports. The troopers would need an extra position to investigate those. We did insert language in the bill, the very last section of the bill, to ensure that there's no retroactivity in this legislation. So as soon as the bill passes and becomes law, then the requirements on missing persons reports would be in effect from that day forward. So they wouldn't have to go back and actually conduct all this work for all of the cold case missing persons reports. There's also language in the legislation that the Department of Public Safety, which they've been working very closely with the sponsor and us, on drafting this legislation. We appreciate their help. They have some concerns about mandatory language in the bill and prefer that the language is permissive instead of mandatory. If the committee decided to take that step, fiscal notes would more than likely go down dramatically or become zero. But that would be a whole different conversation altogether, because at that point there may not even be need for the legislation. So we're continuing to work with the department, and the sponsor, Senator Green, has asked the department to come forward with some other language to consider. And so if this bill is scheduled for another hearing, then we'll consider that at that time. We'll see what they come forward with.
The bells have rung calling us to the floor of the Senate, but we are going to take just a couple more minutes and try to wrap this up. I'd like to go to Ms. Weir, who's online, and if you could please keep your testimony to roughly 2 minutes, because we have been called to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mary Weir, and I'm the mother of Samantha Bonnell, who disappeared September 24th of 2005. And unfortunately, it took 19 months to find her body. If the criteria that I'm asking to be collected had been collected, the process would have been almost immediate. I can't even begin to explain the trauma it brings to someone's life to have someone missing. But, you know, to change the wording of this bill to permissible would really defeat the purpose, because all of the identifying criteria and the systems are in place and have been for many years to make these matches in the identification, and they're being severely underutilized by the state of Alaska as well as most other states. And I'd like to see that, you know, that they are used. As far as the cost of the bill goes, there is going to be costs involved, but I think the cost in hunting for and maintaining websites for missing people, there's significant cost there that would go down. I just really think that this is really important legislation, and the systems are already in place. There's federal funding and federal grants available for this through the National Institute of Justice, as well as through CHI, the Center for Human Identification. And I think it would be a travesty to not have this pass. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And I have spoken with Senator Green on the challenge you had with your family member. So we're aware of that here. We have any final comments, questions? I don't think we have anybody signed up in the audience, and that takes care of everybody online, and a couple other people just for answers. So we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside then for a later date. And if we have no other final comments by committee members, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., February 21st, we're going to have four bills up. Senate Bill 201, Public Finance Website. Senate Bill 122, Municipal Property Tax Exemptions. Senate Bill 204, Municipal Tax Exemptions from Combat Deaths. And House Bill 67, Municipal Property Tax Exemptions. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.